labor and the people of the industries and manufacturers, they wanted cheap labor. At the same time, the labor movement is beginning to become bigger and bigger. They wanted cheap labor. Now, the assumption was that the children of ex-slaves would be cheap labor because they worked in the South in plantations after slavery. Now, they wanted cheap labor, however, that had some skills or some discipline. And in the first Great Migration, there were two Great Migrations, one roughly from 1915 to into World War II. And the second that comes after World War II, they're very distinctly, socially, culturally very different in many ways. I'm generalizing, but if you examine it, you'll find that that's pretty accurate. And so my family came in the first Great Migration. Most of the people who came in the first Great Migration, though they had been, many of them had been children of slaves, they were urbanized in many ways. They were drawn from the urban communities of the South, Birmingham, New Orleans, Atlanta, Nashville. They were somewhat city, and they had learned how to organize. Why did they come? They came for the same reason that Europeans were leaving. Europe, they came for a better life. Particularly, they were fleeing tyranny of the South, the terrorism, the lynchings, and the brutalities of the South. And they came to be able to participate and vote. And they came to get better education for their children. So they had a different style. When they were met by some of the relatives and friends who were already here, they were told certain habits. You know, you don't spit on the sidewalk, you don't walk on the grass, you don't talk too loud. You know, all of those little amenities that we take for granted, which would not be true of people who lived in the rural agriculture because of the space, even the space differences would make, have to shout a little louder. And so they came and met, most of them settled on the south side of Chicago, which is now called Brownsville. It was then called by Robert Abbott, who was the founder of the Chicago Defender, was called the Black Belt. The region was called the Black Belt because we were literally hemmed in by agreements called restrictive covenants that the landlords and landowners would not sell or rent to people of color. And so there was a race riot in 1919. I'm moving fast, too fast maybe, but a race riot in 1919 in the 31st Street Beach, where there were petitions where blacks were not supposed to go across those petitions. And so a group of young blacks canoeing somehow went over to the other side accidentally on purpose. And one of them was killed. Now at the same time, World War I is over, and these new blacks who are coming in, like my daddy, pretty aggressive people, they were not prepared to take any beating, so they began to fight back right away. And then the veterans from the World War I returning, finding it out, they broke into the army where they had been trained, pulled out guns, and they began to fight back. And for the first time in America, blacks retaliated, and pretty soon the riot was over. There were many people injured and much damage was done. Now, where I live now in 449 in Drexel, I can walk to every house and vacant lot where I've ever lived. I mean, literally walk. You young people don't walk like that anymore, but I still can walk. And I can literally walk in there. And yet, I could not cross without some degree of harassment. The west to the east side of Cottage Grove, and I could not without possibilities of being physically attacked to the west side of the Rock Island Railroad track. So Robert Abbott described that as the Black Belt, literally from about 22nd Street on the north, and gradually block by block by block to 67th Street on the south, from the east side of Rock Island Railroad track, the west side of Cottage Grove. But within that framework, we developed parallel institutions, parallel cultural, social, and as our two musicians would tell you, the jazz and the blues, later gospel, all emanated from that little space where we would find businesses of various kinds. You know, I was getting ready to die, I had to wait a while because there were no funeral parlors, and so we had to get some funeral directors. Getting ready to get buried, there was no place to bury me, so we had to get some land so I could get buried and come. Some of the traditions, of course, which had brought up from the South, from that same kind of existence. So the first 12 black CPAs in the country came out of the Black Belt. Now, in that period of time also, there was the Great Depression. The Great Depression from 1929 to about 1940, where work was very difficult all over the country. And Herbert Hoover was the president, and he said, prosperity is right around the corner, but I kept looking around the corner and I didn't see anything fruitful. And so eventually another man was elected by the name of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he literally stopped what was going to be, what looked to be an internal strife between the intellectuals, black and white, and that's when the Communist Party began to have more impact in Chicago and across the country. And so World War II comes. I remember I was in the tavern on 63rd and Vernon, and me and my friend were talking about the things, and that was my birthday, December 7th. Heard that that the Pearl Harbor had been bombed. And I wasn't on television in those days, and so we were listening to the radio and they kept saying, so I turned to George Oliver, who later became a famous playwright, and I said, Pearl Harbor had been bombed, but she shouldn't have drank so much. The assumption was Pearl was a woman. But I found out that I got and life changed again. And many of us, of course. And then Mr. Hansberry, Carl Hansberry, Lorraine Hansberry's father, began to buy the property. And we could move into Northwest Woodlawn. And then in 1948, the breakout came with Shelley versus Kramer, where he took another case to the Supreme Court, and restrictive covenants were no longer enforceable, and the neighborhood then changed. The diffusion of the population and the newcomers began to come, and they brought very few, because they had not been permitted to develop, they brought no strong educational attitudes, or no strong political attitudes, no political culture. And that is what took over, because those of us who could leave the old Black Belt, with few exceptions, left, and left a vacuum, left in isolation. And then the jobs began to go away, and drugs began to come in. And that was the way in which folk, young folk particularly, felt that they existed. Jobs went away, families began to deteriorate. So what we will see today, the history is physical, and to the extent that I can discuss it, and our musician friends can talk about it, you will get some glimpse into the past. Please feel free to talk. Some of you know more about it than I do. Feel free to correct me, us, and offer your own opinions and anything of that sort, and hopefully you will have a day that you will enjoy. I certainly will. I learned more from you than you will ever learn from me. Thank you very much. Thank you. As well as in the field of in politics and entertainment, that became a mission. Sports was similar to that. Rube Foster, after blacks were excluded from organized baseball in the 1880s, 1890s. People like Rube Foster, not Rube Foster alone, began to think of ways in which they could develop their own baseball arena. And so Rube Foster was a businessman as well as a great baseball player. And he conceived the idea of the Negro Baseball League. And Charles Comiskey was preparing to expand the White Sox Park. He had a park at 37 and Wentworth. because he and Ruth Foster had a good relationship, he practically gave the smaller park, which became the American Giants Park. And that idea expanded all over the country. And so he had the Negro Baseball League. Some of the memorabilia you have seen here is kind of reminiscent. Now, they apparently they're doing some renovation there. They have much more. And the young people who have created this is to retain the memories. Memories crowd the corners of my mind. Precious memories of the way we were. Could it all have been so, if you pardon me for messing up the song, but you got the idea, that those memories are treasures. And so they are determined to retain those treasures. That's not to diminish or demean the present. It's to remind us of the past and the struggles and the faith and the confidence that is necessary to keep on keeping on. Because without that faith and confidence, which is a universal quality of life, we give up. And the enemy always tries to batter you so you will give up. But if you have the memories of the struggles of people, then you're determined to move forward. So the Negro Baseball League continued all over the country. The leader of the Kansas City Museum had just died about a week ago. He's 94 years old. But as a kid, living in the general neighborhood, we would walk and live with the person right down the street. We would walk over to the Sox Park in the daytime, and then we would stay and have some lunch or something and go to the American Giants Park because they were playing night games way before it became popular to play night games. So we'd spend the whole day looking at baseball and dreaming. And some of my contemporaries wound up playing in Negro Baseball Leagues. And then, of course, in 1947, when baseball was beginning to be less popular, I forget his name, but the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, saw a young Negro guy who had all the qualities, not the best player, but he had the qualities that could fit into the big leagues. And he purchased and honored a man by the name of Jackie Robinson. And I would go out to the Cubs Park. He's playing for Brooklyn Dodgers. We'd go out to the Cubs Park, and we would be cheering if Jackie Robinson dropped the ball. And the wife said, "We said, what's wrong with you?" We said, "As soon as you get somebody that looks like Jackie Robinson, we'll be cheering for him too." In other words, you got an evenly playing field, but you do it by being equal or better than being even. And this place is designed to try and bring those memories so that we can see that equality in itself among people who are not in the power positions requires persistence, faith, as well as talent. So along the street here, blue attracted people from all over the world. And my musician friends here can tell you some of that story. So while we're waiting for lunch,
China Factory. And the front of the China Factory was on Calumet, and the rear of the China Factory was on King Drive. And Dad reversed it. You'll hear me say Dad, it was my father, but we were like this. So I would, he told me I was the son he never had. So that's why you'll hear me constantly say that.
I'll confirm that part.
Pardon me?
I'll confirm that.
Thank you, Tim. The The other significance of who are the Griffins? Very good question. Well, where you're standing, as you must know by now, was Civil War Camp Douglas. It was one of the few camps in the North that permitted African Americans to join the Union Army and be trained with armaments. Most of the camps that were African Americans were allowed to join the Union Army were trained as nurses or servants or cooks. But this was one of the few camps that were trained, they were trained with armaments. Dad's grandfather, Corporal Charles H. Griffin, was inducted in the Civil War right here where you're standing. January 5th, 1864. His original induction papers are in the main lobby of the funeral hall on display in the curio cabinet. These are copies of his induction papers in the Heritage Memorial Wall. Dad built this wall in memory of the 6,000 Confederate soldiers that died here and the fact that his grandfather was inducted here. 4,000 of the 6 that died here are buried in Oakwood Cemetery at 67th Highland Hills. 4,000 names of the persons that are buried in the Confederate mound in Oakwood is listed on the four sides of the monument. The owners of Oakwood Cemetery were sympathizers of the Confederacy, and at the about 1910, they decided that they didn't want any African American to be buried in Oakwood Cemetery along with the Confederate soldiers. So families had to have their family members and loved ones disinterred and reburied. We had a family member, and we have the disinterment papers from that disinterment. It's dated February 4th, 1912. Unbeknownst to the owners of Oakwood, there are 10 sentries that are buried in front of the mound to guard the mound. One of the 10 happens to be an African American, so they didn't get everyone out. It was not until the signing of the Civil Rights Act in 64 that we were allowed or permitted to be buried in Oakwood Cemetery, the signing of the Civil Rights Act. And that's rather pathetic, even in death. We are honored to be able to tell the story of the 6,000 Confederate soldiers that died here. Being a funeral home, as you are aware, we respect and honor the deceased. And for that, we do fly the Confederate flag at half mast every day that the weather permits. No, they're not flying today. We're not open on Saturday or Sunday. Tim Black twisted my arm and my leg and my body and told my wife, and my wife said, no matter what you're doing, you know, pause and do it. So I'll have to deal with Tim myself. I can't deal with my wife. I'm sure most of us do. Confederate flag has never flown above the American flag. It's flown on this side of the wall, and it's at half mast with the prisoner of war flag, the POW flag. And on this side, the American flag is flown at full staff with the freedom flag. So we do try to recognize everyone. It is, Dad built this with his own money, his design. We do not accept or receive any funds from any municipality, government, or otherwise. This allows us to do what we wish to do, and with no ties or anything. Dad designed this, built it. The north side of the wall has the 25 flag that depicts the Union Army or the Union during the Confederacy. The artifacts in the wall are from the Civil War. The south side of the wall had the 11 flags that are representative of the Confederacy. So the south side of the wall faces south, the north side of the wall faces north. There are, on both sides, there are copies of Grandfather Griffin's induction papers and an outline of what was Civil War. There is one building left standing from the Civil War. It's at 35th and Lake Park. It is now a home for abused Catholic boys. The original stained glass windows are still up and can be seen from the street. They do welcome tours. It's St. Joseph's. They do welcome tours, and it's across the street from Stephen A. Douglas's tomb. And Stephen A. Douglas's tomb is the smallest state historical park in the state of Illinois. And if you've never been there, I strongly suggest that you do. It is absolutely gorgeous. And again, all the home for the boys, they're more than happy to invite you to my house. Not at the spur of the moment. I think you have to make arrangements for that. I'm going to ask, I know that Tim would, I don't know where he is, but that's okay. I want to show you the music hall because it does have a pictorial history of the funeral home as well as the music house. I want to tell you because I won't be able to talk with all of you or to be able to speak with you at those locations. But you'll also see a Stradivarius upstairs, and you'll also see a left-handed French horn. I'm going to something that you will not see too. You won't see too often. Please take note of the handles on the door. I ask that you please be careful because they are delicate. They're up there decoratively, but they are instruments that we do try to preserve as handles for the doors. So they we try to follow the theme of music hall. We have had funeral services up there for musicians. It's a perfect venue for a service for musicians. And yes, jazz has been played, not quite on the order of New Orleans, but quartets and quintets have been on stage and played during the visitation. The music hall is currently being used, it is used for receptions for families that are having services here. And occasionally it's used for community activities, but it is not rented out. Available for anything other than for our families that we serve. The you'll see photographs from approximately 1934, 36 to almost the present, to 92. We only use coupe de fleurs. We do not use hearses. Well, a coupe de fleurs is a flower car, and you will see what a flower car is on that pictorial history. You will also see some original sheet music and, I'm sorry, records, wax, real wax, on the wall that are displayed as some of the music that we sold or produced. I'm going to stop at this particular point and I'll try to answer questions as we go upstairs. I just ask that you please be careful. Understand that the building is not open today. I've got to go ahead and turn some lights on. Some of you can follow me up if you'd like. It's not going to take them a second. Okay.
Brought into the American War in 19, when the war started in World War I. General John Blackjack Pershing, they wanted to fight. They wanted to be on the front. General John Blackjack Pershing was going to deny them that opportunity because he didn't want to see them as heroes, as had been true in the Civil War and others. The French Army took them in as combat troops, Marshal Foch and Marshal Pétain.
took them in. They spent more time on the front line and percentage-wise spent more casualties than any other single unit in World War I. There is a monument around the corner to them around on King Drive. Unfortunately, we are out of time. But to those who were killed in World War II, they come back to the United States. They come to this neighborhood, and a race riot has occurred. They broke into that army, took the arms out, and began to fight back. And that, of course, reduced the onslaught that may have occurred. In this army also, a team that you probably heard of called the Harlem Globetrotters did not come from Harlem. They came from that high school where we just left, Wendell Phillips. They were known as the Savoy Big Five and were owned by a black man by the name of Dick Hudson. Saperstein was an advisor to the team, but Dick Hudson got into trouble with some of these young men who were very bright. Some of them had gone to colleges like University of Illinois and been beat up by their white adversaries. So they left and came back. And so they formed this team, and Saperstein came in from the north side. He was a British subject originally. And he came in and he bought the team, and because he was a business-oriented man, he renamed them. You know, Chicago has always taken second place to New York. So he called it the Harlem Globetrotters. They were not from Harlem. One of my cousins on that team, he lived right around the corner. But it was a beautiful thing for me because they were like our big brothers. And I learned how to play pretty good basketball. So good that I was considered all city at one point on the team here in Chicago with those New Sauble High School. But it was a place where I saw when Benny Goodman integrated his band with the Benny Goodman Trio. They played at this place, and the same night that they were playing here, Joe Louis was fighting at Comiskey Park for the championship of the world, Jim Braddock. He had been beaten 2 years earlier by Mark Schmeling, and that was heartbreaking, not just to blacks, but to America, because Schmeling was German. Now, when Joe beat Jim Braddock, he brought his entourage across 35th Street, and Benny Goodman with, what's the drummer?
Gene Krupa.
Gene Krupa and all those guys. All these guys. And we were sitting there, and they were playing
Moonglow.
Moonglow. It must have been Moonglow. Way up in the sky, it must have been Moonglow. And we just cheered and cheered, and music brings people together. Jazz music, blues music, you communicate in a way that is almost hard to describe. And so on that particular night, we just had a good time up and down 35th Street and all around. It was beautiful to be here. So the Armory itself has its own history in and of itself as a place where things happen.
The same year the band decided to break up due to money, basically. This is the Sunset was here, the Plantation was over here where KFC is, and down the street from there was the Apex Club. We were listening to the Jimmy Noon Orchestra on the bus, the Apex Orchestra with Earl Hines. They played around here too. This was the spot in 1925. What Frank and I are going to do is what Louie and King Oliver used to do to try to draw the crowd over to the club they were playing at when there was too many people across the street at that club. They would come out on the sidewalk and sort of battle across the street at each other. We're going to see if we can raise some spirits here. Ha 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 ha
Say hello.
Hello, everyone.
Sharia.
My name is Sharia Battle, and I handle sales for the Parkway Ballroom, along with Rome Street Catering, who handles all of the service. We are a full-service venue where we offer you not only the food, but also all of the setup and, of course, the cleanup. We're totally uniformed, and we also do on- and off-site catering. So, enjoy. Thank you.
They've been built by a black insurance company, the Metropolitan Funeral System Association, and had moved from 47th Street here. Must have been 1939, probably. And anyway, a friend of mine, Carl Cotton, now deceased, said we are going to see this because we had made a commitment in our early years that never would Duke Ellington come to town and we would not see him. So we heard that Duke was going to be here. And we came to this site, which had been a vacant lot and had been a garage in the back where the owner of the garage, who was an airman, was training young blacks to be able to fly. Not that Fort T-47 is where they fly now, but those little planes that you could reach down the street and shake hands with your friend. But he was teaching them to fly. Later, many of them became Tuskegee Airmen. So we came to this site, and we walked up the stairs. Very different than it is now. Beautiful. It's still beautiful, but different. It's a different kind of beautiful. Can you move that to the center? What, that doesn't hear well?
I want to get you on tape.
Well, you know, I talk loud enough with you on tape, but anyhow. So we walked up the stairs, and it was a winding stair. And our pride was so deep that we said, oh my God, look at what they have done. That we have done this. And we used the word that none of you white folks should use. Look what the niggas have done. Don't you use that. That was how, how joyful. And we walk in, and Ellington has his great band, one of his great bands. He had just returned, I think, from Europe. And he had created, in honor of Elizabeth, Good Queen Bess, and other numbers. He had refused to go into Germany because of Hitler. So we're in the midst of evolving history. And this is a piece of that evolving history that black men and women with money begin to build something of their own rather than inherit, to begin to build structures that had been done before, but this was unusual. And Duke was playing. Cootie Williams had just left the Duke. to be an arranger, I think, for either Tommy Dorsey, or anyway, he had left. And Duke had written almost spontaneously a number called When Cootie Left the Duke. Great number. But in this hall, from that point on, that was the opening night, it was a gorgeous experience. You did not come to this hall and, well, you must buy yourself a Tubbs Men and Tails Derby, top hat, and you acted like a gentleman. You danced a waltz. It was not a hall where you could say, I think I'll go there and pay you in. Only invitational sororities, fraternities, and special kinds of clubs, the exclusiveness. And so the weekends we would wind up doing two things. Many of us young people could get it anywhere. We would spend a little time here dancing very nicely. Then we would go down to the Savoy and do the jitterbug, which is, you know, a little different. But this building was built, and this hall was built as a service, as a place for the community, not to make money, but as a place of service for the community in general. But the community that was organized in various groups, and so almost everything that happened here was invitational, and you look forward to having a good weekend. Now, we'd leave here and go to Savoy, and that's where we'd have a real fun. We would practice being middle players, you know. Practice, you know, being middle players. Got to practice on how you're going to do it. Hee hee hee, ha ha ha, that crap. But anyway, but the point is that this was a historic spot because of its origin and because of the kind of the quality of people who came here. And the place was available and open for organizing. Paul Robeson I saw here singing. And last time I saw Paul Robeson was here. And he was with the famous
Marian Anderson.
No, no, he was later in Europe, he left Chicago.
Josephine Baker.
Last time I saw them, they were right here in this place, and it was something else. And so that's the last time I saw.
Did white people come?
Pardon?
Did white people come?
Oh, absolutely. More white. You know who Paul Robeson was, and Josephine Baker. you had to shut them out. I mean, it was the style. And of course, this is point of time when we are dealing with the issue of integration even in the Army. When Robeson and Baker, Josephine Baker was a fantastic woman. I saw her in Paris, and she had adopted about 8 or 9 children across national and racial lines. But she grew up here in Chicago. I mean, her professional development was right here in Chicago, in the neighborhood where we just left, around 31st Street, around that area. And she went to New York, and she went to Paris, and she just stunned people over there. So she, but the an important part of this is that it has been that through the efforts of developer L.J. Higginbotham was doing a lot of work on the South Side. This place has been preserved. And now it's a matter of popularizing it again. It's a neighborhood changer. And it does have events here. I've been to several, and it's always enjoyable. Now, when I was growing up here, when I was here, it used to have a bar and a restaurant in this, almost in this spot where we are now. The dance floor was around here. The bar and the restaurant were open
all day. And the business people along 47th Street, white and black and all, would come here to have lunch and stuff like that. And so it was a place to come and enjoy yourself, regardless to the time of day or evening. And so, memories again, at the corners of my mind. I'm always glad to share them if they have any value. Because we all have memories. And we all have places where we grew up. We all have places where we enjoy. And those are the things that give us the thrill of being alive and continue to go and grow. And I'm so happy that I've had the chance to experience your very, very beautiful company today. Maybe in the future it will happen again. But this is a very important. Oh, this was the insurance company downtown, stairs, that was downstairs. I was making money. And that was, you know, my mom had been telling me, go back to school, go back to school. I make more money than my brother, but she wouldn't give up. That woman just nagged. You know, got it. And my daddy was no better. He said, why don't you do what your mama said? So I was trapped. But it was in this place that also that I saw a struggle go on. We were agents on the street. You know, we'd knock on people's doors. You want insurance. It sounds crazy now. You know, now people open the doors and I want to sell you some insurance. It was a burial policy, you see, it was a burial policy. And that building next door was the funeral parlor. And the funeral parlor had its own, it was related to this. And so I had, if my client and everything happened in their house, they could call me up at home and I'd advise them how to proceed to take care of the burial. That burial parlor at that time handled more funerals than any other burial parlor in the country, Metropolitan Funeral System. The white metropolitan agent from the Metropolitan Insurance Company, seeing us on the block, wanted to capture our clients, but they couldn't because they just couldn't. So they sued the Metropolitan Funeral System. They sued them to make them change their name. Now, people like Earl B. Dickerson and others, Lorraine Hansberry's father, but people in that category, they took it to court, went all the way to the Supreme Court. And so they had to change the name, but they could keep the Metropolitan in, and it became the Metropolitan Mutual Assurance Company, rather Metropolitan. And they had to give up the funeral parlor and all. And then after that, the white companies began to see that blacks could sell, and they began to weed off the better black agents. I had opportunity to go to Mutual of Omaha, being the first black with the Mutual of Omaha, and there were other blacks who went to Metropolitan Life. One of my friends went, and he was on the $1 million round table for about 20 years as an agent, because he had this market, which previously whites had said, we don't want you. And he could pick up all of those kinds of things. So I won't agree with segregation as being a thing that should be pursued, but there can be some advantages. If you know how to manage, you can have the advantages of feeling oneness. You can control the market that comes out of that. The dollar used to turn around the black community 5 times. Now it hardly gets in. You look at the Chinatowns. They keep their community. They move. They go where they want to go. But they keep the Chinatown. And some of us think we may have integrated too fast, too messy, too quickly. That has nothing to do with integration. I want to live where I want to live. But I want to also keep some of the things. Thank you. Is there anyone have any comments or questions? Have I bored you enough? Thank you very much.
We'll have a chance to talk to Dr. Black some more on the way back. But at this point, we've got another special guest appearance. Very pleased to announce that from the University of Chicago. head of the Collegiate Scholars Program, really great program for getting local high school kids into college. And a poet in her own right, Kim Ransom, is here to tell you a bit about the thriving poetry scene in Brownsville. And there's just so much going on, I keep saying this over and over again, but it is just so true. We can scarcely do justice to it. We can't even mention all of the things going on that we would have liked to get on our tour. But Kim is going to give you at least a little introduction. Thanks.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon. I'm so honored to be following Mr. Black. It's really an honor to even be an exhibit, if you will, on your tour today. I was born and raised in Chicago. I'm a Chicago Public School graduate. I went to Thornwood, too. That was part of my high school, but Morgan Park, Wacker Elementary School. So I've been on the south side of Chicago all my life. I currently live on 53rd in Michigan, and it's rumored that my building is the building that the guy who started the numbers game in Chicago, that my building is his building. Do you know his name by any chance? I don't.
I know his name from
Give a Damn
Jones.
Okay.
And his brother, T-Nan Jones.
Okay.
And T-Nan Jones in the 1890s learned how to gamble, how to organize gambling in Hyde Park. And came over again. Now, he organized it later. The Jones brothers, Ted and they come later, but T-Nan is in the 1800s and 1900s. And he had a brother by the name, I forget his name, but anyway, because all we knew about was Gilbert Adams. And he'd go wherever and bet on something. He was a gambler. He'd bet on something. And if he'd lose, and he'd look around and say, I don't give a damn. So he got the name. Wherever he went, Paris, wherever he went, he'd look around. If things weren't going the way they should, he'd say, I don't give a damn.
Well, it's rumored that the people, I live in a rehab building, and they found these machines. 5346 South Michigan, right across from Hope Church, Missionary Baptist Hope Church.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to stick this right over here.
And the contractor said he found these machines. Well, but anyway, so I'm here today to talk about poetry. I'm a poet. I do run a program at the University of Chicago called the Collegiate Scholars. But also in my other life, I'm a poet, and I've been reading poetry in Chicago now for over 10 years. I started reading poetry, at the DuSable Museum, I believe, was the first time I read poetry. But what is happening in Chicago is like this kind of new renaissance of spoken word artists and poets all over the city. And I just happen to be one who is rooted in the south side of Chicago. So I used to host a poetry venue called Jazz and Java on 35th and King Drive for a number of years. And it was just a fantastic little coffee house. And on Thursday nights, I mean, it'd be packed with some of Chicago's best, some actually who have gone on to be featured on Deaf Poetry Jam on HBO. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that. And just really, really wonderful. So since then, there's Jazz and Java is not there anymore. But there, if you're interested in poetry, there's Poetry and Jazz that goes on 47th Street at Little Black Pearl Workshop a couple of times a month. Borders on 55th has poetry a couple of times a month. There's a coffee house on 43rd towards Lake Park that has poetry once a month. And then I just got something on my MySpace. Yes, on my MySpace. About another place, and I can't remember the name of it, but then there's Swift Mansion. They also have poetry, and I don't know if you guys went to the Southside Arts Center, Community Arts Center.
Not.
Okay, but they also have poetry sometimes over the years. I don't know if they still have it on a regular basis. But I started being really active in the community. I worked on 39th in Michigan at Elliott Donald Youth Center, which used to be the Boys and Girls Club and the Boys Club way back when, and I understand
with some others. And I was running a program for teenagers who live in the community. And back then, there was still the CHA housing projects were still standing at that time. And so a lot of my students lived there as well. And I was supposed to be running a program to keep kids off drugs and out of jail. And to me, it just sounded like an AA group. What teenager wants to join an AA group, even if they are an alcoholic, right? So I decided to make it a college readiness program for teens, and it was actually very successful. Many of my students have gone, I mean, they're in their 20s now, you know, but they went off to college around the country, doing very well. And one of the things that I did to inspire the students was to start this poetry night at Jazz and Java. And you know, we're not into poetry, Miss Kim. We're not gonna come to that, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, just come and hear me, you know. So it was an adult night, and I promised the coffee house I would do it for free on Thursdays if they would allow my teens to come, and they said, sure. So lo and behold, like after a month or two, this place is packed with teenagers and adults. You have your chess players over here, and suddenly, young men are being mentored by older men. It just became like a natural mentorship place. The girls over here cackling with the older women, and it just, I mean, amazing, and people just standing room only. So, I just stopped by to read the little poem. Also, what has happened is that a big surge has come about in self-publishing. I was one of the first people in my generation to self-publish her own book of poetry. It's called The Black House. And it was kind of inspired by my time. I wrote it during my time at Elliott Donnelly, and a lot about just, I guess, me being a young 20-something and the work that I was doing with the kids and my notion about this community that I had grown to love, that I would see, you know, on TV. I mean, when I went to work at Elliott Donnelly, my dad was like, okay, you're going to get shot going over there trying to, you know, do something good. So. And just out of his own fear and notions about what was going on in this place that was once a jewel that, in my mind, I guess, stumbled upon some difficult times. And now we're in this regentrification stage, and a lot of people are being moved out and pushed away, and I don't know. So at the time that I was working at the center, this book came out of that. So I'll just read a couple of poems. The first one that I'll read is called Supernatural, and it's about, well, you'll know what it's about when I read it, but it's about a girl who basically meets a guy on the expressway. So. I saw him cruising on the Dan Ryan, and sister girl, I ain't even lying when I say he had that look that caused chemistry. Little did he know, but he was soon to be the center of my joy. Pull over, that's what his deep brown eyes said. And before I could think another thought, I was caught up and led over to the shoulder. Now I could have been bolder, but opened only with a, hello, my name is Miss Ransom, and what a handsome fellow you are. He said, I know, now follow me over to my car. You see, my friends, this is my Mercedes Benz, and none of my friends make the kind of money I do. Baby, it's true. I am one of the few that you read about in the papers or see on the news. And statistics say my kind is dwindling fast, so I couldn't understand why you could pass me by. Well, I understood the words that fell from his face and onto the curb, and the material things he was revealing might have been appealing had I given a damn. But being the woman I am not interested in the interest accruing on his savings bonds. In fact, I wanted to yawn all over his tired excuse of a rap. He needed a slap to assume I'd be all on his tip because of the gold that dripped down from his neck. Maybe I should wear a sign to free some brothers' minds that reads, please give some respect. You see, I make my own money and ain't a damn thing funny about you trying to play me with your papers or pimp me with your possessions. And I'm just betting it never even dawned on you that God might be blessing me too. And this may sound bold, but I am supernatural. So call me heaven. And like heaven, I ain't letting nothing through these gates that ain't righteous. Oh yes, I'm righteous. And that is the way this is. You see, I like my men naked, but I don't mean X-rated. But if you've got sense appeal and can keep it real, then maybe, just maybe, we'll holler and slip slide away. But my heart ain't interested in no gift getting, so if this is all you have to say, then please just step up and out my face. Because quiet is better kept than to keep on preaching on what you got and what you make. I live in a spiritual world, and here, if it reads man-made, it's fake. I'm created by the Creator, and from Him all my blessings flow. I'm from a higher, so to me, you are no Messiah. This weight is worth more than gold. And this may sound bold, but I am supernatural. So call me heaven. And like heaven, I ain't interested in getting nothing but your soul. That's it. By a girl, a little girl, who now works at the University of Chicago, actually, but I started mentoring her. She was an Elliot Donnelly, that's how I went there, and she was a straight-A student, and she was pregnant, she was 16. And she, I don't know, you guys may not know a lot about black girl hair, but it's an art. It is definitely an art form. You can do many, 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 many things with your hair. And I think because over history, you know, we've had to shapeshift into a model of what beauty should be like, that oftentimes young girls grow up feeling bad about the texture of their hair. And in our culture, there is something called the kitchen, which would be this space right back here. You can perm your hair to straighten it, but no matter how much you perm it, this little kitchen part back here seems to just want to do its own thing, and that's called the kitchen. So Mimi one day, she had extensions in her hair, she had braids, and you know, as your hair grows out, the roots are not going to be braided, the roots are going to be, you know, your regular hair. And she's like, oh, I need a perm, my roots are showing, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, it's not, it's beautiful. So hence, I wrote this poem called The Kitchen Blues and My Cotton. I used to be ashamed for people to look into my kitchen. Not because of the dirty pots and pans, but the kinky nappy strands they'd sometimes see at the nape of my neck. I couldn't hold them down, and it turned my world around to hear someone say, when's the last time you had a perm? But loving myself, I've learned straight ain't always good. I think my kitchen's been misunderstood for too long. This mane is strong, versatile. Every day I bust a new style. I can press and curl, wrap and tap, tie it up in a knot, or let it hang and do my thing. I can dread it and let it grow to my knees, or dress it up with cowrie beads. Slap in some gel for a slick, smooth groove, or pick it out with my afro tools. I can finger wave, bounce and behave, pump it up, or let it lay flat and ironed. Dig all the things I can do. Bet you didn't know I can fade it too. I guess I got it going on, too black, too strong. The power is in the puffs, all rough and stuff. With this cotton candy crown, you can come around my crib anytime. I'll be letting my roots grow, show, and shine, because I'm proud these locks are mine.